Good morning. Everybody's awake today, and I see there are different like seats and stuff. Aren't we creatures of habit, by the way? Usually like we sit in like the same area and stuff, like, you know, so I'm like thrown off by a couple people today. This is kind of interesting here. I'm Chris, by the way. I'm the pastor here at Table Life Church, so it's great to be here with you, and I hope you are staying nice and cuddly and cozy and not hunkering down when it's dark at 4:30 in the afternoon, but that you are ready to go out and to share the hope and the light and the love of Christ wherever you go. So we are in the third sermon in this series. This is the last one, about, we're calling it, we've called it Puzzled. It's making sense of God in the Old Testament. And really some of the confusing things about how sometimes the picture of God in the Old Testament doesn't seem to line up with the character of Jesus. I don't know if you've ever wondered that. Well, if you have, you are in the right place, because we've been talking about that over the last few weeks. And the last couple weeks, if you missed those, I encourage you to go online, check those out. They're on Facebook, YouTube. You can go ahead and rewatch some of those things. But we've been also kind of using this illustration of puzzles. And so just by a show of hands once again, who are our puzzlers in here? Are you getting ready for the holidays? You're going to get the puzzles out with the family, put them out. You know, last week we showed a video of the speed puzzlers that did like a 500-piece puzzle in 14 minutes. So if you are one of them, I think we're going to sign a couple people up for that national team at some point. But if you've ever done a puzzle, there's sometimes that you're just about done, you're just about finished, you have most of the pieces together, and then you realize that there's something wrong, that your dog is eating a piece of puzzle. Anybody ever have a dog or a pet kind of steal a piece of a puzzle? Or even more fantastic, is a small child coming up to the table, right? And either dumping the table over and you're like, no, right? It's like slow motion. Or like taking a couple of the pieces and chewing on them or running away with them or those kinds of things. You know, have you ever had that happen? It happens more often than you think. Even in my own family and story, over the holidays sometimes, especially Thanksgiving, we put a puzzle together. I participate periodically. I'm kind of those people that like swoops in, puts a couple pieces and like leaves. The rest of the family's like working on it. And would you believe it? My happy pet cat, you can show that picture, Aaliyah. There he is, scanning the puzzle. What will he do next, right? Just as we finish the thing, did he just complete the puzzle, or is he ready to dismantle the puzzle? But sometimes like it can be unnerving, right? Especially when you're like missing one or two pieces and you can't find them anywhere. And you look, and you're looking in the box, you look, but somebody stole them, somebody took them, something stole them, took them, it moved out of the way. It can be really unnerving, can it? Like when you can't finish the puzzle, you got the one or two pieces left. Well, I want to make the connection there, because sometimes our faith can feel like that too. Is that like our faith, you know, first and foremost in Jesus Christ, sometimes it can feel like it has a couple missing pieces or questions that we've had. And so for some of us, as we've been talking about in this series, for some of us, when it comes to God, that unnerving and kind of missing piece has been the pictures of God in the Old Testament that don't quite show the love of God that was demonstrated on the cross in Jesus. And for some people, that's a really, really big thing. And I don't know, maybe that's part of your story. Maybe you have a friend or a family member that said, well, I can't believe in a God like that who did those horrible things, like slaughtering babies, having armies just go into towns and decimate people, taking women and using them, and like a God who approves of all that, right? It can be really unnerving when you wrestle with that. I mean, there's so many times that God seems to punish people violently and do things in the Old Testament that don't quite line up with Jesus, and it's a real obstacle for people. And another kind of illustration or comparison would be like, it's like if you're dating a wonderful person, and then you learn down the road that they kill children, right? You're like, they're wonderful, they're a wonderful, loving, and then they like kill children in their background, right? Could you trust him or her now? Do you want to go forward with that relationship? That can be kind of like our relationship with God. You know, we love Jesus, but what about the stuff in the background, right? About what God demonstrates, about what those things are. It can be a huge barrier to trust. But you know what's wonderful? Is when you can find that missing piece, or at least at least make peace with that missing piece. And so we've been talking in this series that it's first and foremost important to start to view the Bible through the lens of Jesus. That if we want to know what the character of God is truly 100% like, we have to start with Jesus. Jesus is the center of Scripture. He's the center of our faith. And he's the full revelation of God's character. And we have to believe that who Jesus is that full demonstration of who God is. And last week, we looked at how God is willing to stoop down to us. He reveals his beauty, his wonderful nature, his love by stooping down to us, to our level, even to bear the ugly sin of the world, to take on things that are not his job or things that he is not responsible for. And he reveals that love by getting down to our level and getting in our mess. Aren't you grateful for that? I don't know, I'm grateful for that. Like, God doesn't give up on me when I'm really messy. Like, no, he dares to stoop down to me and be with me and to show me the way, even despite my brokenness, how I keep messing up. And so when we look at the cross, isn't it true that both people that believe in Jesus and who he is as the Son of God and people that don't, unbelievers, both of us, see the surface of the cross. We see Jesus on the cross. But we as believers, we look through the cross by faith to see God, what he was doing by stooping down to become our sin, and what God was working behind the scenes, and even the death and the pain of the cross to do something more. And it's kind of stated like this by the Apostle Paul in his letter to 1 Corinthians. He said this: "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, for the unbelievers. But to those for whom we are being saved, it is the power of God." Right? You can look at the same thing and have two very different perspectives. One, to say, well, this marked Jesus' failure, right? His destruction. He deserved that death. He's a criminal on the cross. But then as a believer, you look through that and you see what God was doing through that pain and through that purpose. And so since we see God's true character through Jesus, we can see in the Old Testament that God is stooping down to accommodate the sins of his people. And that he even is willing to be characterized in ways that are not godly to stoop down to their level. It's like, you know, if you're a parent, right? You have to meet your kids where they are. You can't say, okay, I have all these expectations over here. No, you have to kind of take things in steps. And that was actually the belief of the early church, by the way. In the first few centuries of Christianity, the early church kind of wrestled with that idea of like, well, these demonstrations of what God did in the Old Testament, how does that line up with the character of Jesus? And one of the early church fathers, his name is Novatian, he said this. He says, "Israelites viewed God not as God was, but as the people were able to understand." It wouldn't have made sense to have all these things that the ways of life and things that people should have been living at that time, to go to them and say, okay, God, God's like, boom, here, you got to do all this, right? No, God moved with the people. He viewed them and he worked with them as they were able to understand. You know, I kind of think of it like one of my favorite children's books is the Bernstein Bears. Any Bernstein Bears fans? So I remember as a child reading this book. And I don't have any younger siblings. I am the younger sibling. So this wasn't about like, hey, surprise, we're having another one, like that kind of thing. But I remember reading this book as a child with my parents. And just kind of refresh your memory. The little bear, he has his little bed in his room. And Mama Bear and Papa Bear, they come and they say, hey, you're outgrowing your bed. We're going to make you a new one. And we're going to make room for a new little bear that's on the way. So the story goes that little bear goes with Papa Bear out into the woods to cut down trees and make the new bed. And they get wood and they are coming back to the house and they walk into little bear's room. And you see on the screen that there's no bed there. And so what happens? They walk into the next room and lo and behold, boom, there's a baby bear. Like, okay, a lot of questions there, right? I don't know. As adults, right? You look at that, you're like, okay, the baby bear needed the old little bed, the little bear's bed. And so now we can prepare and be celebrating and look, there's a new little bear in the family. The end, right? The end of the story. Everybody's happy, you know. You read that, but there's a lot of gaps there, right? As adults, you're like, oh, there's lots of things that I have questions about. And but you know what? To a child, that doesn't matter. When you're at a child's level, like what they want to know is like, okay, where's my old bed going? You know? How do we prepare for that? Where's going to happen? Okay, there's a new little, that's going to use my old bed. I get to be the older sibling. Like, you communicate at the child's level. And that's kind of like what God does with us, that he meets us where we are. He stoops down to our level. And even times when he does that, even when Jesus does that, it can come across as condoning our behavior. Meaning like, oh yeah, he approves of that, right? But then you see Jesus as hanging out with sinners and tax collectors and prostitutes. People at Jesus' time, they actually called him a drunkard for doing that. Was he approving of their behavior? No. But he rather took on an appearance that reflected that to meet the people where they are. And that's the character of God, just like a really good parent, moving us towards what's good, but starting with our position first. So that's kind of the backlog there. But the question that I want to get at today and ask today is the question of how do we make sense of God's use of violence in the Old Testament? Like, how do we make sense of God's use of violence in the Old Testament, specifically as he addresses sin or to judge sin? And so through the series, you know, you might look at the last two messages and say, well, God stoops to us. He loves us. He meets us where we are. Maybe God doesn't judge sin. And the answer to that, of course, is no. He does judge sin. But if we base our understanding on the cross, it's clear that God judges sin. So the question, therefore, is then what does God do to judge sin? What does God do when we don't go his way, when we choose our own way? Well, first and foremost, it's important to remember this, and I think Isaiah says it best in Isaiah chapter 55. He says, for my thoughts, this is God speaking, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. We have to remember that God is not like us, that our instincts, the things that we want to do, our desires, our first inclinations, are not always of God. That God's not like us. And most of the time, we assume that God's judgment has to equal a way that we often judge or we often punish through violence. That's our image, though, not God's image. That's our image. We assume that God's judgment, therefore, must line up with the way that we punish people. But it's not necessarily true because the cross challenges that. See, the cross is God's judgment on the sin of the world. And before we look at God's actions in the Old Testament, we have to first look at Jesus, go back to Jesus on the cross, right? Jesus went to the cross for our sin. And while judgment on that sin took place on Calvary, it was violent and horrible. All the things that were done to Jesus were not from God, but they were from wicked human beings under the influence of evil. It was not God putting Jesus on the cross and putting those nails into his hand. That was not God. That was people. That was people doing that. But two ways that God acted in the midst of that to judge the sin of humanity was two things. Was first, to withdraw, and second, to allow. Those are the things that God takes responsibility for. First, is that God withdraws his protection. God simply withdrew his protective presence over Jesus and turned Jesus in to the wicked human beings. And even in Romans, and Paul writes this in chapter 4, he says, he who was delivered over because of our transgressions and was raised because of our justification. He was delivered. In Romans 8:32, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? So that word deliver, it's this little Greek word that's paradomai. And sometimes, you know, when I see the word deliver, what do I think of? Domino's pizza, right? You deliver, right? Call the phone, deliver my pizza to my door. Like show up at my door and physically take action to do it. But that's not word that parodomai actually represents. The kind of deliver is more like to surrender, to give up, to give over. It's not like actively, hey, here's Jesus, go here and do this. It's like, have your way. You really want to do that? I'm giving up. It breaks my heart, but I'm giving you over. That's the kind of withdrawing his protection that God does. God could have intervened. God can intervene. He can do it. But sometimes he withdraws his protection. And that leads to the second point, is God's second action is to allow. God allows. God sometimes allows sin and evil to have their way. See, the people who crucified Jesus, they didn't want God's way. They didn't want the way of Jesus as he was demonstrating how God is. They chose their own way. And what that way was death. Was death and destruction. You know, let me like illustrate this. You know, if you've ever been had someone in your family who's wrestled with an addiction, or maybe you've had a close friend who has done that, and maybe it's been over a period of years, over and over, the struggle going on, there comes a time that you have to let them go. There comes a time that you can't protect them anymore. And it's painful to watch, and it breaks your heart, and you cry, and you cry, and you cry, but there comes a point that you have to allow it to happen. Because there's no other way for them to learn or to grow or to even get out of it. And it's just like, you know, or being a parent, right? There comes a point that you can't protect your kids anymore when they're 40 years old. You can't. You have to let them go and make their own decisions and face their consequences. And you as the parent, it breaks your heart to see them make bad ones. But you have to allow them. And that's the case that God is demonstrating here. God is still there. He doesn't withdraw his presence. He withdraws his protection. And he allows us to go our own way, to have our own way. And we can see the same thing, thinking about that, God's actions of withdrawing and allowing. We see that going on in the Old Testament scriptures. And so we find that while the biblical authors, they often ascribe this, like, horrendous violence to God, it's very interesting that their own accounts then later make it clear that God didn't do the violence they ascribed to them. We're going to dive into a couple of those. Maybe you've read passages before that it's like, God did this, and then you read later in a different book, it's like, no, God didn't do that. He allowed that, or somebody else took action. That it's clear that God withdraws protection and then allows the evil of the world to take control. He allows people to make their own bad choices. And we see that in several passages that kind of give us clues in that. So the first one I'm gonna look at is the Passover. Okay, the Passover. You heard this maybe in Sunday school growing up, you know, the story of the Passover, you know, watch the Charlton Heston movie, right? You have the Israelites who are working under the rule of Egypt, and then you have Moses who is called by God to free them and to let my people go. He goes to Pharaoh and tells them, and Pharaoh won't let them. And there's a series of plagues that then happen over the Egyptians. But then the most important one of them is that God, in the story of Passover, God is going to strike down every firstborn. I'm going to look at Exodus chapter 12, verse 12. It says this: on that same night, this is God, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord, right? God is going to slaughter all the babies. It's kind of bad, right? It's kind of horrible to think about. But what's interesting is 11 verses later in Exodus chapter 12, verse 23, we see something a little bit different. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the top and the sides of the doorframe and will pass over that doorway. And he will not permit who? The destroyer to enter your houses and to strike you down. So who does the striking? Well, it's corrected as later, it's not God doing it. It's God withdrawing and allowing the destroyer. And the early church characterized the destroyer as the forces of evil and Satan, who wanted to kill anyone he can. See, the Lord was restraining that from happening the whole time. So what God does, God withdraws his protection. That's what God does. Even in the author of Hebrews in the New Testament, let's flip all the way to the New Testament, after Jesus, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 28, by faith he kept the Passover and the application of blood, so that who? The destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. Not God. Not God. That's of evil. That's who is taking action. But God withdrew his protection and allowed it to happen. See, the Bible had never dropped out of the sky, friends. It wasn't like a magical book that all of a sudden appeared and people had it. No, that the Bible was written by authors over 1,500 years that lived at different points in time that God used, but lived in their own culture, that they had their own pictures of God, just as we, you know, start off with our own pictures of God before we're taught about the person of Jesus. And they had to learn over time that this God was different than the gods that the people that surrounded them, the people that worshiped different gods around them, and that they weren't used to God's ways, that they were used to a God who was ferocious and killed people, a God who worked through violence and destruction, a God who the people of different religions would praise when he was ferocious. They weren't used to a God that operated much differently by withdrawing and allowing. Even in the fall of Babylon, that's like the second example. So the fall of Babylon, which happens centuries later, we have Jeremiah and Ezekiel, all the prophets, in the same passages, they talk about how God is going to do this. So in Ezekiel chapter 21, I will pour out my wrath on you and breathe out my fiery anger against you. I will deliver you into the hands of brutal men skilled in destruction. The same word, by the way, when we translate it into the Greek, the same word of deliver, right? Not Domino's pizza deliver, like I'm walking to give you over, but the surrender deliver, the have it your way, right? That's the Burger King, right? I guess we're going here, right? Have it your way. Like, have it your way, God says. Have it your way. That's how God acts. He allows the Babylonian forces to take them over. And you read through the eyes of the character of God, a loving parent whose heart breaks when he sees his kids acting horribly, but he allows it. He allows it. Another prophet, Zechariah, says this, he's characterized by God. God is saying, I'm very angry with the nations that feel secure. I was only a little angry, but they went too far with the punishment, right? He's like, I allowed it, and they went a little bit too far, right? They kind of carried on their own reasons. We see that in the exile story. He's talking about the Babylonians. See, friends, God is not a puppeteer. He allows us, he gives us the gift of free will, which can also be the curse of free will, to allow. But he sees in this scenario that they went too far. But then the third story that I want to look at quickly is the crossing of the Red Sea. Crossing of the Red Sea, back to Moses, back to the people, right? They're escaping the Egyptians. The Egyptians let them go. But then Pharaoh's like, oh, change my mind, right? So we're going to send the chariots after you. We're going to send everybody after you. And then we see, I'm going to look at it through this lens. So we see first in Exodus chapter 15, part of that story, the Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army is hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. You stretch out your right hand and the earth swallows your enemies, right? Isn't that like a mean thing? Like it just, boom, they're gone. Smite them, right? Some of us have had that characteristic and had that view of God. God seems scary. We justify that they deserved it. But then you have to ask the question, a couple chapters later, what happened to commandment number 6? Thou shalt not, what? Kill. Like, God doesn't, says us, got to do that, but does God do that? Well, what's interesting is that this episode of the Red Sea is referred to another dozen times by biblical authors, not as a depiction between a fight between the Egyptians and Israel, but as a God and evil. That's really what's going on here. Because we see in Psalm 77, it's characterized a little bit differently. With your strong arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. When the water saw you, O God, when the water saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. So one thing, imagine the people of this time, they had a very different view of the world than we do. Once again, God stoops to our level, pre-scientific thought, and he used it. And the worldview of the time, thousands of years ago, was that each of the natural forces had its own little, like, God type or power. And one of them was the god of the sea named Yam. And the biblical authors, they were wrestling with this view of who, this god of the sea. And they were wrestling with a view of a god overall. saying, which one is it? But they were still kind of torn between the two. And the sea was seen as chaos, as symbol of chaos. By the way, the roof is not going to open up and suck us out. So we're fine. You're safe. It hasn't for like, what, how many decades? 70 years now. So we're fine. So, but anyway, the God of the sea is the God of chaos. So whenever you see the word sea, like you think of like the ocean, like sea water body, it also represents chaos. Very well, it's the water, but also the chaos of evil having its own way. And so what the author believes and sees in that passage, the water is basically parting because God is holding evil at bay. God is withdrawn. God is protecting. And what happens when God doesn't protect no more? He withdraws. The waters come in. See, for God to bring judgment means he stops protecting and he allows. And that's consistent through scripture. We see even when Jesus talks about separation from God, you know, sometimes we think of, oh, well, hell is this burning place and whatever. No, it's getting what we want. It's saying, no, God, I don't want you. I have my own way. I want to follow my own God. I want to do my own thing. And what does God do? He allows that. He allows us to follow our own way. See, because the authors of the Old Testament didn't have the full revelation of Jesus, they couldn't see truly what was going on. But we can see who God is, but also how God was willing to stoop to their level, just as he is willing to stoop to our level, allow himself to be portrayed in ways, but also what God was doing through it and how he allows it. So what does that mean for us? Well, maybe you're still puzzled. Maybe there's still holes in your puzzle that you're figuring out. Well, first and foremost, it's worth noting that not every bad thing that happens is God's judgment. And I want to make that clear. So the thing that just happened to you probably is not God's judgment. You know, it might be. It might be a way that you've turned or gone direction, but you just got that diagnosis. That's not God's judgment on you. We have to recognize that. But what God allows is our choices. And sometimes our choices not only affect us, but they affect others. You know that in your family and your friendships. There's ripples that happen. It's not just about you and your choice. God also allows the brokenness of the world, the sin of the world, that we would all admit that the world doesn't work as it should. There's something deep inside of us that knows that that's wrong. But God allows that. And he allows the forces of nature that are broken. He allows the wind and the rain and the earthquakes. He allows those things. And I believe that that breaks God's heart. And he allows those things not because he's a mean God, but because he's a loving one. He's a loving one. A loving God that allows our choices to have the consequences that they do. But in the midst of it, to show us that it's never the end. See, the disturbing parts of the Bible show us that the brokenness of humanity is real. And for thousands of years, people have tried to fix ourselves. We've tried through governments. We've tried through regimes. We've tried through trying to have good positive self-talk and all. None of it has worked, that we are still broken as humanity. But God continues to be willing to lead us through it, allowing us to make choices and to have our way. But God doesn't give up on us in the midst of it. And it points to the end of the story that he continues to promise to us, even in his allowing. A number of years ago, there was a man named James Stockdale. He was a general in the army, and he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for about 8 years or so. Those are just some pictures of him. He endured lots of torture as he was a prisoner. He refused to be used in manipulation by the army, by the other army that tried to use him for all kinds of publications and whatnot. He refused, so he was tortured in the midst of that. And after he was released and rescued, and he went for a couple of interviews and whatnot. One of them was in this great book called Good to Great. What's his name? Francis Collins? No, Collins. Anyway, he was in this interview, And he was kind of sharing his story about, like, how did you survive such harsh conditions and bad things that these people did to you? And he not only shared his story, but he shared a really poignant quote saying, well, all that time that as I endured such torture, as I endured such pain and hardship, I never lost faith in the end of the story. Never lost faith in the end of the story. And I think that for many of us, that's the last piece, and that's the first piece, is to cling to that and to know that there will be things in the Bible that we wrestle with and struggle with, and we should ask great questions. We shouldn't check our brains at the door when we come to church. But in the midst of it, the last piece to hold on to is to never lose faith in the end of the story. That even though, yes, maybe as a parent or a friend, you have to allow some things to take place in other people's lives, you can't rescue them or protect them any longer. That yes, maybe you have to stoop down and you have to be among people, and maybe there are people that everybody's going to think of you differently. But no, you are called to be a part of that community, or you are called to help people and meet them where they are. But in the midst of all those things, to never lose faith in the end of the story. And if you're going to hold on to any piece of the puzzle, I encourage you, hold on to that one. To know that regardless of what this life holds, and maybe tomorrow will go great or maybe it won't, maybe someone else's decision will impact your decisions, maybe something will happen or something will go great, whatever it is, to know that regardless, God has promised that he will redeem all things. His promise is good, and the future is good as well. He's promised us the gift of eternal life. He's promised us a day when all will be made well. He's promised us to hold on to the trust that a relationship with him contains, to hold on to the piece of the puzzle, and not to lose faith in the end of the story that he has. So let's pray.